Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On April 22, 1970, millions of people around the world mobilized to celebrate the first Earth Day, helping to kickstart the modern environmental movement. Today we talk with Dennis Hayes, who coordinated the first Earth Day, as once again all around the world we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which in light of the COVID-19 pandemic takes on a poignant meaning none of us could have imagined 50 years ago. Dennis, welcome to Locus Focus.
It's wonderful to be here, Barbara.
Today I got an email from a furniture place online that they say that they make sustainable furniture, and it was an ad for an Earth Day sale. And I thought, that is something that would have been really hard to imagine in 1970. I just wonder what you think about how far you've come in 50 years.
It's not a source of great pleasure to me. That's the first time that I've actually heard of an Earth Day sale. And in fact, I've sort of bragged on occasion that America, which has this tendency to use everything to sell merchandise, often things that people don't need that they can't afford and they pay for with money that they don't have. But we have these events like Memorial Day, which is honoring people who gave their lives in service for the country, or Veterans Day, or Labor Day, or heavens, Christmas, and it's all used to just hawk merchandise. And I always have the one-liner that says, I don't think I've ever heard of an Earth Day sale, and now you've ruined that speech impediment for me.
I was actually pretty shocked myself. I mean, this is surprising because I've actually done business with this company and I bought a thing I really liked from them, so I was a little bit shocked, but it just seems like everybody is on the one hand freaking out about the end of the planet as we know it, and on the other hand is trying to make as much money as they can while there's still a planet left.
Yeah, that's the American way.
So let's talk about the beginnings of Earth Day. I think you're pretty well known as being the original coordinator for Earth Day, but I think a lot of people probably don't know whose idea it really was. So who came up with the idea and how did you get involved in starting it?
The idea was initially an idea which evolved into Earth Day. It was really from a senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, previous governor of Wisconsin and a two-term senator, who had, maybe before any other politician in America, a sense that this issue was ripe to explode and be of significance. So his idea was that you should try to organize campus teach-ins on the environment. I was initially hired to try to make that happen, and pulled in some very talented organizers, sent them out across the country, and they came back sort of saying, not going to happen. The activists on campus were still focused on the war, on civil rights and early feminism, on some cultural issues, some local campus issues in various places, but the environment wasn't ripe at that stage, and a teach-in wasn't quite right. A teach-in was what you did when you had a debate. Is Vietnam the first domino in something that would cause Laos and Cambodia and Burma and Thailand to fall, or is it a perfect sort of colonialism example where the Chinese came in and mastered it for a while, and then the French, and then the Japanese, and then the French again, and now the Americans? We didn't have that kind of debate on the environment. There was nobody saying, boy, we don't have enough pollution. We ought to be having more pollution. We need to generate more toxic substances. Let's drive more creatures into extinction. This was something around which there was a fairly broad consensus about what we ought to be trying to do instead of what we were doing. So we took it off of the college campuses, rechristened it from Environmental Teach-In into Earth Day. The new fleet of organizers were actually mostly women between the ages of 25 and 35 that had small children at home, often college-educated, generally single-income families. Mostly had never been involved in anything political before, and many of them turned out to be just superb organizers who cut their teeth on Earth Day. And then after the momentum started building up, the students piled on, and we started getting a big youth engagement in it as well.
How did that happen? How did the students get involved?
The issue was starting to get a lot of visibility. They were beginning to understand that we were talking about the use of Agent Orange in Southeast Asia. We were talking about rats in ghettos and lead-based paint peeling off of walls and children eating it and damaging their nervous systems. We were talking about air, that breathing it is the equivalent of smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, and rivers that were catching on fire, and just the enormous split between how we were measuring ourselves as a country. The progress is measured by gross domestic product, and the quality of life, the elements of fairness, the sorts of elements of the American dream that were being sacrificed on the altar of gross domestic product. And as the students began recognizing those broader implications of it, they too decided to get engaged.
It's interesting when you talk about the intersection of all the issues you're really dealing with back in 1970, because it sounds a lot like the environmental justice movement today, and how I was thinking how the environmental movement, which in many ways, I mean, for most of us, I think started on Earth Day. It had been going on for a long time before that, but there was a new consciousness that certainly engaged way more people after April 22nd, 1970. But after that, it seems that there was a period where they became like the large environmental organizations that were a little bit more mainstream and also much more single-focused. And then in the last few years, we've seen this coming together. People talk a lot about intersectionality. I wonder how back in 1970, why that kind of intersectionality was so much easier to envision than maybe it was in 1985.
It was a little bit of a stretch in 1970. When you talk about the environmental movement being there in the 1960s and the 50s and the 40s, what really existed then was, one, a conservation movement that had some shared values to preserve open spaces, natural areas, often the result of contributions from rich people who wanted to go to those places and shoot things. But the issues tended to be relatively focused. The people who cared about Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and protecting birds didn't tend to think at all about urban air pollution or about rats in ghettos. The people who were worried about the Santa Barbara oil spill were not much worried about the Everglades. These were just targeted strands. And a central goal of Earth Day was to take all of those diverse strands, I mean scores of them, which shared values but didn't view themselves as being related, and weave them into the fabric of modern environmentalism, where everybody worked on one another's issues and had far greater strength in their numbers. The shift that you're talking about that then went away from that early intersectionality into things that were, being really blunt, more upper middle class, more white, more college educated, less diverse, I think was not the result of a conscious plot. It was the result of some structural issues. That was an era when we didn't have a whole lot of technologies that are commonplace, including the ones that we're using right at this moment. And if you were fundraising from people, it was almost all done with direct mail. And that was something where the margins were really thin. If you got 1.5% return, you were doing pretty well. If you got 1% return, you were losing money. And so people really tried to get as high a return as they could. And it turns out that white middle-class college-educated people tended to respond to direct mail much more than other segments of society. And once you've got that started, then the organizations that were funded tried to do more of the activities that appeal to the people who were parts of their membership, because they were a membership organization designed to serve those interests. And those tended not to be things that applied to people in poor inner city areas or people who were involved in the war. It was people who were concerned about whales and redwoods and pollution. So it just became this self-reinforcing phenomenon until the last several years, where there's become this increasing awareness that we've got some very major discontinuities coming ahead if you do something akin to a Green New Deal. It's fundamentally restructuring the entire American economy. And that's not going to work if it's got the focus that we have right now, where big parts of America were not actively engaged in environmental issues. So there's been a very concerted effort to reach out to communities of color, to reach out to disadvantaged communities, to reach out to anyone that has not historically viewed the environment as being significant or relevant to them, and see if we can convince them that it is. And that also obviously involves us being interested and concerned and trying to be helpful on the issues that have historically been their priorities.
It seemed to me back in those days that there was a lot more environmental awareness on the West Coast than there was in the East Coast. On the first Earth Day, I was a student in New York. I remember it very strongly, except I can't remember where the event was, but I'm assuming it was Central Park, and I think there were, hundreds of thousands of people. It was a very large event, as I recall. But there were a lot of friends that I had who, for whom environmental issues didn't resonate because they were more like hardline leftists, socialists. They were fighting the Vietnam War and fighting all these other things that they thought were political, and they didn't think of environmental issues as being political. And I came to Oregon, and it was a totally different reality, and environmental issues really became one of the core things that I was concerned with from that point on. But I went back to New York to visit some friends in the late 70s, and I was talking about the environmental concerns I had, and I was actually getting involved with stopping the Trojan nuclear power plant just north of Portland. And they thought I was just wasting my time, and I was just doing fluffy things, and they were fighting the real fight. Several years later, one of my friends commented on that visit I had and said, well, actually, now we talk about environmental racism, so you were ahead of the curve. But I wonder what kind of happened that people started understanding that there was a strong connection between economic issues, social issues, political issues, equity issues, poverty, and how that is all part of being concerned about protecting the environment and protecting the environment of people who live in these conditions.
Through the 60s, initially, a lot of things began pretty peacefully and with an effort to try to broaden and diversify the support for the anti-war movement, the support for the civil rights movement. The anti-war movement reached out aggressively to the religious community and did a lot of things with organized labor and civil rights groups were using Gandhian passive civil disobedience, putting their bodies on the line, behaving differently than the state wanted them to, and letting the state damn well adjust to it. You know, you don't want to serve me at this lunch counter? Well, I'm going to sit at this lunch counter. If you don't want to serve me, you're not going to serve anybody because I'm going to be in this seat. I'm going to drink from that drinking fountain. I'm going to sit wherever the hell I want to on this bus, and you guys can adjust to it. But it wasn't going out and doing anything that was violent. And in both of those cases, massive frustrations, although in the civil rights era, they did pass a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act, but that was then followed by the assassination of Martin Luther King and just an incredible emotional upheaval across the country and riots in a great many cities, and the anti-war movement split into the Weathermen and other radical factions that began planting bombs. And out of all of that, there came this idea of what is truly radical, and you are more radical if you are throwing a brick through a florist shop window than you are if you're trying to organize thousands of people to change the law, to change the way that companies are allowed to behave in a fashion that is destructing the prospects for the future. And in all of that, yeah, I got condemned by some people in 1970 as obviously working for the CIA and trying to deflect attention from the war in Vietnam. And when I really got frustrated with some of this stuff, I alleged that, you know, when this war is over and the troops come home, unless you do something that's a whole lot more than anti-war, you're not going to do anything because the military-industrial complex is going to remain intact. We're going to have the capacity to do that same sort of thing elsewhere. You're not talking at all about nuclear weapons. You're not talking at all about violence in society. It's all about bring the troops home. That's not a radical objective. That's a really small, little, narrow thing. Whereas what we're talking about is changing the entire basis of the American economy. I can't claim that that argument was heroically successful with some of my more radical friends, but I genuinely believe from the beginning that this was a much broader range of concerns, and that if we could hold them all together, that it would not be an anti-war movement, a civil rights movement, an environmental movement, a women's movement. It would be the movement, and that was really the objective.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dennis Hayes, who coordinated the first Earth Day. So I'm kind of curious, where did you go from being the instigator for Earth Day, or at least the coordinator for instigating Earth Day, to where you are right now?
Let me say one other thing, Barbara, which is I think you're being a little bit too hard on the East Coast. There were any number of things there. The environmental movement in Pittsburgh against air pollution was really profoundly strong. The movement to clean up the Hudson's River from the PCBs that had been dumped there by General Electric, was a movement to protect the Everglades, a movement to stop nuclear power in the Carolinas. There was just, I think maybe you were hanging with a different group of people when you were in Oregon than the kinds of people you were dealing with on the East Coast, but we had really strong activist organizations, and as a result, some very powerful, environmentally oriented legislators that came from that part of the country. I'm sorry, I went off on my own riff and I've forgotten now what you asked me to talk about.
Well, actually, I was just going to ask you a little bit about your own journey from working on Earth Day to getting to where you are.
Long before Earth Day, I had decided that I wanted to work at the interface of ecological principles and human choices. I mean, in those days, there was no such vocabulary as human ecology, urban ecology, industrial ecology, biomimicry, the sorts of things that I've tried to pursue with much of my life. But that was what I was most interested in. I made that decision in the course of a 3-year hitchhiking venture around the world between the ages of 19 and 22, and finally in Namibia figured out what was important to me and what I wanted to do with life and what I thought I might be able to contribute uniquely. And that has sort of guided me ever since. After Earth Day, immediately after, I actually went off to try to write the book about all of that. I was, with all of the arrogance of youth, I set out to write something that would be the equivalent of Das Kapital or The Wealth of Nations or something for human ecology. And wrote a few articles, candidly found that I just didn't have the knowledge base, didn't have the discipline, didn't have what was needed, maybe the writing talent to do that. And then a number of interesting things happened, mostly just fortuitously. The Arab oil embargo came along in 1973. Much of what I've been writing about, if you're looking at ecology, it's all about scarce energy. How can you use the limited amount of sunlight that is captured by plants through photosynthesis, which really powers all life on the planet, except those of us that tap into fossil fuels, and hence has to be very, very efficient. How can you wrestle with those energy issues in the context of a human society? Much as I said, there were strands that we wove into environmentalism. In the wake of the Arab oil embargo, suddenly we no longer talked as we had before about oil, gas, coal, nuclear, as separate things, hydropower. I mean, we started talking about energy as a fungible thing that within limits could be interchanged one form for another. There hadn't been many people working on that. I was one of the few that had. The governor of Illinois, who had national aspirations, was trying to assemble kind of a national cabinet and invited me to come out and found his energy office and be his liaison for the environment and natural resources in the cabinet. So I did that. Turned out he was more attractive from a distance than he was up close. He was trying to build his own political machine. He did some stuff that I found kind of reprehensible. Like most other governors of Illinois, he eventually wound up in the slammer. And I left before that, and he failed to win his own party's nomination. So I went to a place called World Watch, the World Watch Institute, and wrote a few books, mostly, again, still focusing upon energy as it applies to society. And then was offered a chance to run the solar energy research program. It's really solar, wind, biofuels for the Carter administration, and did that. And then Reagan decided that my services were no longer needed in his administration. So I went off and practiced law for a while, and just to make a living, mostly representing the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, going after sleaze bags who had looted and pillaged their savings and loans in Northern California, and went after them in combination with the U.S. attorney, got them convicted of something, and went after them for criminal restitution. It was a fun job, but it wasn't satisfying and fulfilling the way that my environmental work had been, and when I got a chance to move on, I moved on. The moving on then was I was approached by the heads of some of the national environmental groups and asked if I would try to resurrect Earth Day as a phenomenon in 1990. And I thought that sounded more appealing than my legal practice. But I wanted to make it genuinely Earth Day. I mean, it was up till then called that, but it was really United States Environment Day. And a bunch of issues, climate change, ocean pollution, migratory species across national borders, had all the ozone hole, had international issues that needed to have agreement among nations and enforcement among nations. And so I wanted to take the event out to the rest of the world. So I jumped out, was involved in that for a couple of years. And after that, worked briefly to try to see if we could get consumers to pay more attention to the environmental attributes of the products that they bought. You know, they're most interested in efficacy. It's got to do what it sets out to do. They care about how much it costs, but there also was at least a little bit of potential, we thought, to get them to buy environmentally superior products. That is a whole long episode that doesn't speak well for a whole bunch of companies and a bunch of political figures, but in the end, it was an exercise in frustration. Then I was invited to come up and consult with a family in Seattle, the Bullitt family, that had put the bulk of their mother's estate upon her death into a foundation and were trying to decide what to do with it. And they were considering a variety of different kinds of orientations. And one of them was the environment. And they invited me to come up and talk about what you might do with the amount of money that they had and spend it in the region where it was earned as an environmental philanthropy. So I thought that sounded like a fun project. I did it and then went home and a couple of days later, got a call saying they decided to become an environmental philanthropy and asking whether I would be interested in being the president. And that's how I got here.
So let's talk a bit more about Earth Day in its many incarnations. When you went back in 1990 to try to turn it into like an international Earth Day, how long did it take for it to start becoming the kind of institution that it's been for quite a few numbers of years now?
It was pretty quick. I mean, Earth Day is never been a top-down organization. It always is powered by local organizers and sometimes state organizers. They have to raise their own money. They're going to do things that are important and relevant to them, though we try to nudge them to take other broad themes as well. The international dimension mostly consisted of, we were located in Palo Alto at the time, so we were able to draw upon graduate students from a variety of countries at Stanford and at Berkeley, and we had a couple of very talented international organizers who would bring in these people and let them phone groups at home and individuals at home and try to stir things up in a variety of countries. And it was exceedingly modestly budgeted. I was never able to get any foundations to underwrite anything international, so we had to pay for it out of our overhead budget. But with those student volunteers and those hard-driving staff coordinators, we managed to get events of various kinds into 144 countries that year. Again, very different in different countries because they had to do things that were culturally appropriate to them, politically feasible to them, dealing with issues that were really urgent for them and for their countrymen. I mean, we could have gone to China and said we wanted them to organize a huge crowd event, and that would have been catastrophic had they tried to do it. You just need to be deferential, and we've always been. There's also the aspect that much of the world is deeply suspicious of anything that comes out of the United States. Much more so now than before, but even in 1990, there was a sense of, what makes you guys think that you're so great? Is your environment that wonderful? And we said, no, we're trying to address it, and we're simply urging that you'll join with us in this effort to come together on those issues that we share.
What would you say that Earth Day has turned into in the last maybe decade or so? Because it seems to me every year I'm more aware that Earth Day is this day that is being celebrated broadly. I see it's a big part of school curriculum. And then this year, of course, being the 50th anniversary, there was going to be a huge amount of activity. There still is going to be. It's just going to be different. What was that that evolution like?
Well, it's pretty much as you describe it. It's getting people in a variety of places to place more emphasis on it. The day as a day, its importance can be easily exaggerated. It's a milestone. It's a time for people to review what's happened the previous year, what their aspirations are for the future. It's a day when you get a vast number of people, I mean, around the planet, certainly north of a billion people, to spend some time thinking about environmental issues. And that I think, has enormous value. I mean, if I were a human rights organization or an nuclear proliferation organization or whatever, something to stop female sex trafficking. I would love to have a day when basically everybody on the planet and a huge amount of media attention and other things was focused on my issue every year. And we have managed slowly and patiently to achieve that. Meanwhile, all of those other dimensions that you mentioned remain. This is something in which K-12 teachers feel comfortable taking their kids out into it, because it doesn't have that patina that we were talking about before, that I am more radical than thou. There's a room for people who have very fundamental changes. The Green New Deal is basically replacing over a very, very brief period of time all of the oil, gas, and coal consumed. That's pretty radical. And yet it's an event in which people feel comfortable going out with sixth graders to plant trees and to talk about what they can learn in local botanical gardens, or to talk about the circular economy or other things that are viewed as a little bit less likely to cause parents to protest the teacher's continued employment. And there's room for all of that. This is a day when we're talking about the well-being of the planet.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dennis Hayes, who coordinated the first Earth Day and has been continuing throughout, I guess, the rest of your career to continue to make Earth Day every day, right?
Well, I don't know. I think I may be near the end of it. This was to be my final great thing, where we turned out 1 billion activists demanding that the world's governments get finally serious about climate change. And the fact that it petered out, I promised my wife after 50 years, this would be the last time that I eat up the whole month of April working on Earth Day. And I think maybe I've done my part. There's also the simple issue that, I'm 75 years old. I've never been on TikTok. I don't even know what the heck TikTok is. I'm not on Instagram. It's time to pass the torch to a new generation that really understands these things. So I'll still be around, and to the extent people want to wheel me out every now and then, I'm happy to do it. But I'm not going to be as deeply engaged in the future, I don't think, as I have been.
Well, one of the things I find interesting, and this again is a place where the next generation is just chomping at the bit to really move on it, is you're talking about the real mainstream parts of Earth Day, like kids planting trees and things that are non-threatening. On the other hand, the Green New Deal is also, I guess, a big part of Earth Day, certainly in the organizing that I'm seeing. And there are some people who see the Green New Deal as an overthrow of capitalism, or at least a suggestion that maybe capitalism is not the right route. So I'm wondering how those all converge and how you see this particular Earth Day, which is exceptional, both being half a century old, but also being at a time when climate change is just breathing, panting down our necks, and we are in the midst of a pandemic. How does this Earth Day bring all these different flavors together and all these different kind of threads together to move us forward into a true green world?
Well, I can address that both with what we aspired to do and what's really happened. Pretty much everywhere, the public policy realm has in recent decades been increasingly dominated by, if you will, neoliberal economics. Everything is about internalizing environmental externalities. It's about, if you get the price right, then the market will sort things out efficiently. And that's not true just for capitalist economies. That's been true in socialist economies and social democratic economies and what have you. It's just it got its moment as being the revealed truth of public policy. But it hasn't worked, or it hasn't worked very well in a lot of realms. If you look at putting a price on carbon, what is the appropriate price for something that, as it continues to accumulate in the atmosphere, is literally going to be causing catastrophic passings of tipping points that will permanently impoverish the planet, diminish its carrying capacity for humans and other forms of life? I mean, how do you put that into dollars? It's one of those things that you just can't go there. And so should it be $15 a ton, $50 a ton, $500 a ton. In Washington State, we've twice, and remember, Washington's a relatively well-educated, relatively progressive, relatively green state. We've twice rejected initiatives to put a $15 a ton tax on carbon, thinking that that was a step in the direction toward using the marketplace to move us toward the efficient use of renewables. Well, if you seriously look at it, a dollar a ton translates to use an easy thing we're all familiar with, gasoline. A dollar a ton is a little bit less than 1 cent a gallon. So $15 a ton would be maybe 13 and a half cents a gallon increase in the price of your gasoline. Let's go to the point where no politician in America would go, $50 a ton. I mean, that sounds like a kind of a crazy amount, but that's like 47 cents per gallon. So the gasoline in Seattle, instead of being $3 a gallon, it would be $3.47. Maybe some people will get a slightly more efficient vehicle. Maybe some people will drive just a little bit less. I doubt anybody's going to move to an electric vehicle. That's with a price signal that is almost inconceivable, and it's just not going to do the trick. It'll collect some revenues, and you can do some good things with the revenues, including making sure that they're distributed in ways that makes us a progressive tax instead of a regressive tax. But it's a small component in the midst of things that need to be done. And so where the folks with the Green New Deal are coming from is that they're, and I'll confess I'm one of them, they're not about trying to get the price right and seeing how long it takes elasticity to shift things enough to cut the kind of society that we want. It's much more, let's define the kind of society that we want and take the necessary steps quickly to get there. If you're looking for examples, it would be something like Great Britain discovering natural gas in the North Sea and having at that point heated all of its buildings with something called town gas, which is you burn coal, you pour water on it, partly extinguishing it. It produces this mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide and some trace gases. You send that out in the pipes and you burn that, and it gave low-grade heat for buildings. It also produced a lot of carbon monoxide, which is lethal, and it was tied to suicide rates. It was tied to lots of accidents, and they wanted to replace it with natural gas, which doesn't have that kind of lethality to it. And what they did was take a 10-year thing and marched across the country, and building after building and town after town, they just said, you got to replace the burner in your furnace, you got to replace your boiler, you got to replace this, because we're not going to have town gas 5 years from now, and what you've got right now isn't going to work with what we'll have then. I mean, it happened in a country where coal was still a very important industry, and that was tied up with the Conservative Party, and where coal miners were a hugely important part of the Labor Party, and nonetheless, somehow they commanded sufficient political courage to get that all accomplished in 10 years. Or in China, where they decided, mostly in the wake of Germany's decision to go with a very aggressive program to promote solar energy called a feed-in tariff, that they wanted to be the suppliers of that. And so they sent students off to master electrical engineering and photochemistry and the various elements of making photovoltaic cells, that kind of engineering, and brought them back and gave them free land and gave them zero interest loans, gave them a guaranteed market domestically as well as the German market if they could compete for it, and got them to make investments that rapidly scaled up. And in a 10-year period, once again, they went from manufacturing no solar modules to, at the end of 10 years, manufacturing more solar modules by far than the rest of the world put together. That's the sort of thing you choose a target and you figure out a policy to drive yourself toward it. And having squandered the last 40 years twiddling our thumbs about climate, we've now reached the stage where we have to choose those targets and we have to pursue them pretty aggressively.
So how do you see that the Green New Deal feeds into this year's Earth Day?
Well, again, Earth Day is bottoms up, and there will be people. I don't think that the Green New Deal is going to be hugely popular in Dallas, Texas. There will be different groups that will be doing different sorts of things in different places. But as we talk about it from the national organizing side and the international organizing side, the elements of the Green New Deal are very much like the New Deal. I mean, you had to pass Social Security. You had to pass each of these individual elements. Each of them involved a struggle. They were all a separate law. The whole package came together and is now thought of as a package, but it was not legislated as a package, and neither will the Green New Deal be. So it'll have elements within it that say, we've got to electrify everything and we've got to get all of our electricity from renewable sources. So will there be high-speed electrified rail like every other industrialized country has? I'd like to. Will there be electrified automobiles, basically outlawing the internal combustion engine in cars and light trucks? I'd like something like that to happen quickly. Can we get something that requires that all, and this will be hard because this tends to be state and local, not federal, but I'd like to get every building in America made vastly more efficient than it currently is. The building that we developed at the Bullitt Foundation is a commercial office building, uses one-fifth as much energy as a building built to code, one-half as much energy as a LEED Platinum building. I mean, if every building were as efficient as the Bullitt Center, we'd kind of cut back on our climate goals just spectacularly. 30% of greenhouse gases are used in buildings directly and indirectly. In our case, that would drive it down to something on the order of 8%. So we're going to be doing all of these things, and the same thing with industrial processes, the same thing with agriculture, the same thing with forestry. And in the end, different places will be doing different things in different sequences, but hopefully 10, 20 years from now, we will look back on it as a package that changed the direction of human history.
So do you see that the Earth Day celebration that's coming up this week is in fact going to help to push the Green New Deal and maybe bring some more of these maybe possibly disparate issues together with more intersectionality?
Boy, do I hate to utter these words, but no. It would have. I think we were in a position to turn out, again, more than a billion people around the world. We had Pope Francis had committed to his talk to a huge crowd in St. Peter's Square. We had things in soccer stadiums in Brazil, a big event in Kolkata, India. We were aiming at 750,000 people on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. All of this stuff was supposed to happen. And, COVID-19 just proved to be the ultimate black swan if you're trying to get mass events put together. Instead of 750,000 people, it's now illegal for gatherings of more than 10 people in the National Mall. So, yeah, it was a body slam. We had a huge, talented team spending some millions of dollars over the course of 2 years to do something that just isn't going to happen now as a result of this virus. We will have our digital Earth Day, and if you go to earthday.org anytime that day, Pope Francis is still going to give his talk, and it will be at earthday.org, and we'll have some heads of state and some scientists and some entertainers and some comedians and have some people who will be playing music out in their living room, some well-known musical artists. But that's not the same as 750,000 people demanding radical change, facing the Capitol and screaming at the White House. It's just that's just not going to happen.
Well, somehow we have to learn how to adjust to this reality that we're in for we don't know how long. I mean, you and I are talking right now via Zoom, a technology that I knew very little about until about a week ago. And I know that this is, again, the difference between people of our generation and the younger people who are there in many ways taking over for us, that they're much more comfortable with digital technology. They're much more comfortable with kind of these kind of virtual realities that we have to accept. Do you think there's a way for the events on April 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, I think that's when they're planned for, to have some kind of power that's maybe something you and I maybe can't envision, but maybe younger people can see a way to have a lot of power through these kinds of internet connections?
You know, I try, and at around Earth Day, I try even harder than I do other times to remain resolutely optimistic, even in the face of all evidence. But I don't want to engage in spin that is content-free. I mean, there are lots of ways that you can integrate people on the internet and that have pulled together large crowds. Streaming is hugely valuable, and it's got incredible scalability. it just doesn't have the impact that the huge crowd. I mean, it's like far more people watch athletic contests on television than in stadiums, but it's a fundamentally different effect to be sitting in your living room than it is to be out there surrounded by 70,000 rabid fans who are, you know, kicking up hormones and fiercely engaged. This generational thing, one of the things that is most alarming to me is that we do live in a representative democracy and voting matters. And to turn out in your marches and your rallies, but not going to the polls when there's a pretty clear choice. You may not even have a hero there that you can vote for, but you've certainly all got a villain that you can vote against. I'm just appalled at the way that it's predictable. The older you are, the more likely you are to have voted. I can't kid anybody that this, that there's anything that we're going to do or that can be done, including in the youth-administered parts of this Earth Day Live thing on various days, that will be the same as it was when the youth were out marching through the streets on their strikes, their climate strikes, their Fridays for the Future. But there is a period of 6 weeks, excuse me, of 6 months before we're going to the polls. And it's entirely possible to get folks sometime during that period, as COVID-19 stops being the sort of thing that it is at the moment, confining us to our homes, to have people who have never before done voter registration to go out and do it. If colleges convene in the fall, I think we are going to have a huge and successful voter registration drive on a couple thousand colleges and universities and community colleges and things across the country. And then beyond that, citizen education. We've got this theme of Vote Earth in November that we're going to be pushing virally through every medium that we can. And then there's the get out the vote efforts when November 3rd actually comes around. And I think we can do all of that, and it can certainly be powerfully enhanced by the use of digital technology. But the stuff that we do on Earth Day is a different kind of phenomenon than that. Nuts and bolts political organizing. It's something that if you can't get something that gets a huge amount of, if you will, free media exposure as well as what we do ourselves, it just won't have the kind of ground-shaking impact of seeing in collages on Instagram things that you see this crowd followed by that crowd followed by another crowd followed by 500, 1,000 other massive events communicating to political figures that we're sick and tired of you spinning your wheels. Let's get serious. And I don't see any way to substitute for that.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kebukunji Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dennis Hayes, who was the first coordinator of Earth Day. And we're talking today about what we do right now. Actually, we're talking about what you do when you can't have events around the world massing billions of people, and we are having to celebrate this event from the confines of our own home via internet connection. David Remnick did a very powerful piece that was on the New Yorker Radio Hour this past weekend, and he talked at one point about when this is over, that people will be will come together to celebrate delayed Easters, delayed Seders. I'm wondering, can we have another one of the big events of April, a delayed Earth Day, and maybe have this happen in the fall or whenever we can have mass mobilizations again?
It's possible. And it's among the things that we're considering. We have got the permit for the mall on October 23rd and October 24th, and we might be able to do something then a couple of weeks before the election. With Easters and Seders, you've got churches and cathedrals and ways to generate audiences, and it's just there without a need for doing anything special. You just sort of announce it, and your congregation, or your synagogue's congregation, shows up. Earth Day is sort of different. We need to put a lot of work into creating, to take, again, that same figure, 750,000 people on the mall. It just doesn't happen spontaneously. It And in order to do it, you need to have some lead time and you need to have some money. If it's going to be effective, I mean, just I hate to get bogged into details, but if you're going to do that, you have to have Jumbotron so that people out at the edges of the crowd can hear and see what's going on, or else they're going to drift away. You have to have a really good sound system. You have to have a lot of porta-potties. You have to have marshals to make sure that nothing wacko happens. You need to have crowd insurance, because no matter how good your marshals are, bad things can happen, and you don't want to all be sued into oblivion by somebody who gets harmed in such an event. And it's just thing after thing after thing after thing that you need to do, and you need to make those financial commitments fairly early on, and they tend not to be refundable. I mean, if you order a Jumbotron and then you cancel it 2 weeks ahead of time, they don't have anybody else to take the Jumbotron to, so you don't get your money back. And if you could guarantee me that the COVID-19 is going to be down at background levels and not resurging at all in the fall, and we're not running gigantic risks in doing this, I would actually be quite intrigued. Unfortunately, I've talked to 4 or 5 fairly prominent epidemiologists, and none of them are willing to make any kind of calculated bets at all at this stage.
Well, actually, yeah, Kate Brown made an announcement that there's the plan for eventually opening up Oregon in coordination with Washington and California. And what I was most pleased about it is she doesn't have a timeline. I mean, she's being quite open, and she's very clear about what needs to happen, mainly testing, among other things, is a big thing, and being able to contact tracing. So, yeah, I don't think there's really any way to know what it's going to be like in the fall. And that's one of the I was just imagining, on the one hand, I imagine when this is over and the amount of energy that would be just that's been all pent up, that we just love to come together all over the world to celebrate Earth Day and to really make our voices heard. And on the other hand, not knowing if we're going to have any energy at all, what it's going to be like, how spent people are going to be. How do we deal with that? What are your thoughts about what these different options are that for the various scenarios after the pandemic's over?
You know, I think it's going to take a period of healing. Again, if you were to say that this is not going to be peaks and valleys, that once we have sort of flattened the curve is going to stay flat and it will slowly burn its way through, but it's not going to have a resurgence. There won't be new things coming from maybe the South America, where there might have been a resurgence during the summer months here, and it might be arriving here in the fall, or any of these other modeled ways that you could have a subsequent peak in October that is comparable to what we've been through. I'm quite confident that it is possible to put together just huge, enthusiastic, liberated crowds who are no longer in their homes and want to get out and over and beyond the substance of caring about the planet and about climate change. We'd just like to be out with all of their fellows in a broad community of coming together and saying we've survived. We can't pass those initial stages. It's if, and being really candid, if we were to successfully raise money to do something in October, and it's not at all clear that we can, unless we got a lot more certainty than we do now. And if then, once again, we belly flopped in October because there was a resurgence of this, that would mean 2 failed Earth Day events in a row. And that would be incredibly hard upon the future of this. I think in 2021, it would be very difficult for whoever is there to try to pull together something. At the same time, you never get anywhere if you're all about risk avoidance. I've certainly, in my life, taken some substantial risks that had they belly flopped, it would have been the end of my career. But also, I was probably risking some technologies that if this hadn't worked, it would have set them back some years, and generally have managed to pull that off. And this is not a time for cowardice. But it is a time to make measured judgments, and you just have to have more data than we have now to do that.
Well, I have to say that talking to you for the last hour is taking my mind until the last few minutes off of the pandemic. I mean, it's been really good for me to talk about something else besides the pandemic. And I think remembering back this whole journey of Earth Day and how it's changed the world, I kind of want to end on that note and just think about looking into the future, because the pandemic will end at some point, where we pick up and how we go forward. I mean, you may not be the head of the Earth Day Network anymore, but what do you see that we can, how do we use the energy over the last 50 years of Earth Day to create a new world in the shadow of the pandemic?
Today we begin with a broadly held common set of values that have, you know, we went through this period where in the United States it was viewed as an upper middle class issue and one that wasn't relevant to a variety of other communities. And even more emphatically in parts of the developing world, they're saying, you know, after we get rich, we're going to worry about that, but that's not something that's going to be part of our developmental agenda. And we've sort of passed through all of that. You now see the developmental strategies and the heads of states of so many countries talking about leapfrogging over the worst of the environmental excesses that have been part of the way that Europe and the United States developed. And, you know, for example, never having that intermediate fossil fuel stage that they'll leapfrog directly to distributed photovoltaic arrays with smart grids and substantial storage. And that will be the way that they move into an era that we are slowly stepping our way through. So having gotten into the position where we now have broad, diverse global communities that are all intent upon having a world that doesn't get more and more greenhouse gases accumulating every year, but rather less and less every year, I think it will not just be, it will be, but it will not just be political activists who are working on this, governmental policies that will work on it, but a wide variety of corporate interests who will see market opportunities. I mean, somebody's going to make those batteries. Somebody's going to make those control technologies for the smart grids. Somebody's going to come up with the things that dramatically reduce the amount of energy used in lighting, the amount of energy that's used to power the internet. All of that stuff is going to be coming out of clever, creative, entrepreneurial types. And I think all of that is now coming together in a way that is that can, on a good day, fill me with optimism. And in some senses, we have, for the last several years, been facing a government that has been what we had to overcome rather than the government that we had in the 70s and again in the 90s that was helping us to make that progress. I think it is not crazy to, at this stage, be hopeful about the human future. We are running out of time, but there's something about our species, just like every other species, that seems to be hardwired into us, that is all about survival. And if we really come broadly to recognize that that is at stake, then we will do what is necessary in order to have a future.
Well, Dennis, it's really good to talk to you, especially in these times. I really appreciate all the work that you've been doing, and I'm really sorry that this great 50th anniversary Earth Day is going to have to happen on the internet, but so be it. So thanks for joining us on Locus Focus.
Barbara, it was a pleasure. Take care.
We've been talking with Dennis Hayes, who coordinated the first Earth Day in 1970, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day, you can join the Stop the Money Pipeline Portland Coalition for the 3-day live stream of National Earth Day Live. On Earth Day, Wednesday, April 22nd, participate in a virtual climate justice rally at 4 p.m. and sign up to stop climate destruction by a digital takeover of Chase Bank, the largest funder of the fossil fuel industry. Go to 350pdx.org for more information or to join online. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about all the nasty ploys the fossil fuel industry is trying to sneak past us during this pandemic. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music from Amakor Nina Rota, an album that the eccentric musical producer genius Hal Wilner produced in the 1980s, the first of many such eclectic compilations of talent that he masterminded. Hal died last week of COVID-19 symptoms. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.